This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening, everyone. It is Wednesday night, November 20th. Have a very fun class prepped. I'll start handling these around. But I brought in something special because I just learned about this last week, last Monday even. On Monday nights, I do a program called CERT, which stands for Community Emergency Response Team. For those not familiar, the really super short goal, it's a subset of the, what is it? Oh, they're going to, somewhere division about emergency management of OEM, the Office of Emergency Management. And the goal is for citizens who happen to be on the ground, what is a way that you can respond before the first responders get there? Meaning we don't do, well, I shouldn't say we, because I'm not certified yet, got a couple more weeks left, but it's not like you do major heavy lifting. It's what are the things that you can do even before the first responders come that you might be able to help the first responders out. So this past Monday, we did fire safety, and we learned very important things like how to use a fire extinguisher and some tricks about getting it working better. Anyone actually use a fire extinguisher? Yeah, so it's actually kind of important to learn how to use for two reasons. One, there's this little plastic thing that keeps the pin in, and those are really hard to pull off. So we learned a trick about how to get it off by twisting it. And one of the guys said, if you're in a place that doesn't have kids, you might as well just cut the plastic off beforehand, because if there's an emergency such that you need a fire extinguisher, you really don't want to be fidgeting with it. You just want to pull and go. The other was a matter of technique, because if you spray it incorrectly, you wind up pushing the fire and making it much, much worse. So, you have to do it at the basin. Anyway, the reason why I'm bringing that up is they showed us what is now called the combustion process or the fire tetrahedron. It used to be the fire triangle, which was comprised of oxygen, heat, and fuel. That was the way the firemen used to describe fire. They've since, by describe fire, I don't mean we didn't know what fire was, but in terms of like the ingredients for a fire, and the reason why it's now a tetrahedron is they added in something called a chain or chemical reaction. So if anyone sees like the ABC, fire extinguishers, they work not by shooting water or carbon dioxide, but rather a chemical that disrupts the chemical reaction, and that helps shut it down. Now, that may be helpful or in terms of at least another perspective on how to view fire and see whether or not that applies to an incandescent light bulb. Is there, in fact, a chemical process going there? You may recall Richard Feynman said no, and that's why it didn't match. Now, granted, we're not posketing based on the New York City Fire Department or the Office of Emergency Management, but it does give a very interesting new perspective on how people might view fire depending on your context. All right. Anyway, just thought that was interesting because I learned it this past Monday. If I learned it a week earlier, it would have made those sheets. But that's the thing when you keep on learning and, you know, just constantly adjust and throwing stuff in. Anyway, the main topic of the day, we'll pick up where we left off last week with the Minchat Shlomo, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, sort of laying the groundwork again about how difficult it is to classify where electricity falls in with the existing halachic framework or existing halachic paradigms and laws. And one of the things that we might, I think we talked about a little, I'm blank on if anyone brought that up, is could there be any other reasons behind it that aren't purely halachic? Perhaps there may be something socio-political. And the answer is yes, in my opinion, that it certainly can be. One, it'll take a bit of time to develop this, but I think it's going to be apparent when we're going to go through the next two sources. This entire class is going to be based primarily on two sources that are printed back-to-back in the Igrot Moshe. This is Orach Haim 484 and Orach Haim 485. In the first one, Rav Moshe Feinstein argues that it is prohibited to use a microphone on Shabbat. And in the second one, he argues that it is permitted to use a hearing aid. Yeah.
There's no difference between an active field and a passive?
Okay. We'll go through this.
I was just wondering.
At least we'll go through what Rav Moshe says. First, start us off with the Minchat Shlomo. We saw some of these excerpts last week, so please.
Okay. It is clear to me that according to my opinion, it seems that one has not done any violation of igniting or extinguishing. Rather, whomever connects a telephone with electricity does not violate Shabbat or Yom Tov because of hitting of a hammer or because of molid. However, I think that the majority of the people do not know at all or understand this, and may mistake based on what I have written to say that it is permissible to turn on and off lights. And therefore, even according to our reasoning, we only permit the use of electricity where there is a great need. It seems to me that there is no prohibition to use electric current on Shabbat except when the end result will be done by electricity. Except when the end result that will be done by electricity is prohibited. E.g. cooking or lighting fire and the like.
So where we last left off was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, you know, couldn't really say definitively why electricity was problematic, though he did mention that given that electricity just gives you the power to do stuff, if the stuff that you're doing is prohibited on Shabbat, you wouldn't be allowed to do it with electricity, just like you wouldn't be allowed to do it through other means that are not electric. All right? I gave bad examples last week, but let's say sewing, right? There, you can sew with just a needle and a thread. You know, sew, needle, pulling thread, right? You could also sew with an electric sewer, right? Now, even if you say that there's nothing halachic wrong with electricity on Shabbat, you're still not allowed to sew, right? So I think that's a much better example than whatever I came up with last week. Yeah.
So does turning on the lights fall under that same principle?
Well, we sort of, you know, tabled that for, you know, that particular week. But because lights, we much longer conversation that really goes back to the first 2 weeks of this.
Okay. All right. I was just wondering, like, why he just kind of assumes, well, of course turning on and off the lights is bad.
Okay. So on the last page here, I included a picture I got from a website called explainthatstuff.com on how hearing aids works. And you'll see, like, there's effectively works in the same way as any sort of microphone. In the sense where, I mean, you'll see like the little details here, and that the whole way that this thing operates is, how do you take sound waves, which are, I mean, analog, or, you know, go like that, and turn it somehow into an electrical signal, right? So what you're doing is, there's some form of a diaphragm that when it's, I don't know, what's a good word for it, agitated in some way based on the sound waves, or manipulated, goes back and forth a bit, and that transmits it into electric current, which is then processed to who knows what. In that respect, the microphones, and someone pointed out on Twitter that microphone technology has changed, which is probably true, but the fundamental core of how microphones work are still the same. Where they really differ is, what are the means by which the diaphragm moves? There are some, like, laser-based microphones I didn't know about that can pick up very minute vibrations, but effectively you're turning sound vibrations into electric current in some way, all right? And you're doing that both with a microphone and with a hearing aid. You're taking the analog, making it digital, in some cases amplifying it, making it louder, which is why most people use microphones and why most people use hearing aids, right? So, yeah.
Adding along.
Okay, well, sure. You being one of the, you know, few, I would say, scientists here, you know, might have something to contribute. So, but yeah, feel free to if I'm getting, like, the science or technology wrong. So at the very basic, you know, technical system, they seem to operate nearly identically, right? Taking analog sound, turning it into electric current. Doesn't really seem to fit, you know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's definition of using the sound to do something inappropriate, but let's take a look at it step by step. So again, rest of the class, we're just going to go through line by line these two responses by Rav Moshe Feinstein. My father pointed out that he thinks that there's something significant in that they were printed back to back. And keep that in the back of your mind in terms of to what extent did Rav Moshe, I don't want to say know what he was doing, because Rav Moshe Feinstein knew what he was doing, but perhaps there was even some commentary in terms of how they were published. Don't know, open for speculation. Keep that in the back of your head. Could you start us off, please, with the... First, we just read in the English, and we'll just go around.
Where, here?
Yeah, source number two.
Okay. Regarding the issue of speaking on Shabbat through a microphone, it is clear that it's forbidden, and it has already been publicized as forbidden by the Agudat Rabbanim and Rabbanim or Rabbanim?
No, Rabbanim.
Okay. And even though there are people who do not know the reasons behind this prohibition, it is obligatory to listen to the teachings of the sages, and those who are lenient are not acting properly, even if they are rabbis, and even if people say are great in Torah.
All right, so right now, I mean, this paragraph could have been used in our halachic process class, saying the Agudat HaRabbanim already said that it's prohibited, you're supposed to listen to them, any other rabbis are wrong, even if you say they're great rabbis. Really pulling no punches right at the outset. All right.
So who is the Agudat HaRabbanim?
Good question. My assumption is the heads of what we would call Aguda today. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that's what he was referring to. I'm sure someone who knows Rav Moshe better might say word for it, but that to me makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay. He was just using it generically, and it's, all the rabbis say.
No.
Because people do that today, you know,
because sometimes they'll use other idioms.
Right.
In terms of, like, Rove and whatnot. I'm not an expert in the language of Rav Moshe Feinstein to know what he really meant by when, like what he meant and when he would use one phrase versus another phrase. I don't know how careful he was as referring to it, but at the very least, whether or not it was the official body of Agudah's great rabbis seems to say, well, it's already been decided, and either other rabbis, Imamrim Shehen Gadol B'Torah, even if people say they are great in Torah, which is also a fascinating dig, meaning, one of the questions that we talked about was a matter of reputation as being some determinant. So you say, well, it doesn't matter if people say they're great in Torah. They're just flat out wrong. So because that was a shortened, please take the next paragraph.
And I will explain in brief the two reasons that there is a possible biblical prohibition and the two reasons why it is certainly rabbinically prohibited.
All right, so he's laying out the groundwork here. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, microphones are forbidden on Shabbat for a total of four reasons, however, like two biblical, two rabbinic, the biblical ones obviously being stricter, but he says possible. He calls it a cheshash isur midaoraita. We suspect that there may be a biblical prohibition, right? So he's arguing on one hand a stronger law, but he's acknowledging that there's a weaker case for it. Where it comes to the rabbinic laws, he's saying at the very least, these things are rabbinically prohibited. I know there's a little bit of overlap. This Sunday we just started Rambam Laws of Shabbat, and you may recall what we were distinguishing there between the biblical laws and the rabbinic laws in terms of severity and in terms of how much room you can play with in actuality. So give us, please, the first answer.
Okay. The first, so that's the rabbinical.
Right. So the first one is the first biblical prohibition.
Oh, biblical. Okay.
Or maybe biblical. That's a better way of putting it.
Yeah. So the sound from the microphone is not a human sound, but rather when he speaks, he creates a recording, and what is heard is the voice of the sounds. Okay. This recording is a possible biblical prohibition, even though this is not writing. It is similar in that one. Is creating something new, and by virtue of this creation, a new voice can be heard loudly at a distance. And it is possible this prohibited because of hitting with a hammer and possibly building, and it is needed to delve into the issue of which prohibition it is. And there's a possible suspicion of a biblical prohibition, even though it's not clear what that prohibition would be.
Right. So where Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was kind of straightforward. It's like, yeah, it doesn't really fit. Rav Moshe here in this paragraph seems to be grasping. It's like, well, I don't know if it's this, could be that. We need to delve further to figure out exactly what it is, but it might be a biblical prohibition. And you know, we're talking, you know, at some point in the halachic process, just from this paragraph may seem to indicate trying to find a prohibition. Because Rav Moshe Feinstein's not really clear in terms of what it is. He's saying, well, it might be this, it might be that, but doesn't really explain, like, how is it? Meaning, if by mere replication of sound waves is considered something new, then we wouldn't be allowed to talk on Shabbat at all.
I was going to mention echoes, like, because it works in a similar way, in which it's not the original sound, but it's the vibrations being repeated.
Or you could say it's the same vibration being reflected.
Yes.
And so much is it? Yeah.
This is just the sound wave that's being moved from one place to another place.
I understand that, right? This is what I'm just quoting. I mean, well, quoting my translation of Rav Moshe, you're free to correct me if my Hebrew is off. But the very fact that he says it's needed to delve into the issue, to me seems like he's trying to find a reason to prohibit it. Okay? Right? When he says here, Tzarich la'ayin bivarur ezo melacha, right? We have to, you know, figure out exactly which prohibition is, like, I don't know which one it is, but I know it's something. At least, though, he says it's a chashash. It's a concern. We don't know which. All right, so it's important to remember that. He's not saying it is and forcing it into a category, right? There's a certain ambivalence that comes out in his psak saying it's only a suspicion without calling it definitive. Very important distinction there. Do you take argument number two, why it's definitely a possible biblical prohibition?
Can I ask us?
Oh, sure, please.
Maybe unrelated question?
Yeah, go ahead.
The paragraph above in the Hebrew,
yeah,
when he says "hem rabbanim ve'af im amrim shehen dolim,"
yeah,
is he taking a shot at these people by calling?
Probably. Yeah, he does that every now and again. Meaning, by saying, like, even if people say, when he says, like, even if people say that they're great in wisdom. Oh yeah, I don't know to whom in particular he's referring, honestly, but he does take these shots. For example, we saw in the Politics of Exclusion class. Rarely does he. There was one time when I saw that he referred to conservative rabbis as rabbanim. Every other time that I saw, he calls conservative rabbis rabbis.
Yeah.
He transliterates the English rabbis into Hebrew with resh. Was it resh alef bet yud samach? Rabbis. So those are digs. This could be one of saying, like, even if people say they're great, they're just wrong. But he's done that before. By calling conservative rabbis rabbis as opposed to rabbanim. Hmm. But yeah, good pickup there. I don't know what he was referring to. You'd have to speak to someone who knew him at that time. Hmm. Sorry. Take number two. This is possible biblical prohibition. Number two.
According to the strength of the voice, the power of the electricity will increase. And we find with the speech one is increasing and decreasing electricity. And it seems here a possibility that is connecting another machine that measures speech to whoever measures the voice. Because even without attaching the measuring machine, we know that more electricity is used when someone speaks into the microphone than when someone does not. And when one speaks louder, he uses more electricity. And with the use of electricity, there's a possible biblical prohibition even without lighting, and it's worthwhile looking into this action in greater detail.
All right, so two things. One, again, he says it's worthwhile looking into this more. Certain degree of ambivalence. Talking louder into a microphone, does that make it use more electricity?
Yeah.
Hmm?
Yes.
Explain.
Well, to make the sound itself, you have to move the diaphragm. The louder you have to make it, the greater the excursion of the diaphragm. So the sound, it has to push more air. Therefore, it has to have more energy. And that's more electricity.
Right. There's something going on there. Remember, we asked, I asked Dr. Mincer a couple of weeks ago, like, you know, if turning, you know, speaker louder uses more electricity. And he said, yes. Because the electric is, you're not, how to put this, it's not entirely solid state. Normally, if you would put your speaker on or your radio on and you leave it, it's going to use, let's assume, you know, pretty much stable amount of energy if you let it sit. With a microphone, right, you're doing stuff to it, and you may cause more or less of it. Right, when you move the diaphragm, in terms of how it gets converted to electricity, it might be minuscule. I mean, this could also be another fascinating question to figure out in terms of how do you quantify electricity, and would that matter? And the reason being, there's a general principle in Jewish law that we spoke about on Sukkot that halacha doesn't work on subatomic levels. Right. So the fact that the diaphragm moves around more if you're louder, that you can observe. But moving a diaphragm isn't, much different than, say, blowing on a sheet of paper. Right. The question is about, are you generating more electricity? So how do you quantify electricity in a measurement that's actually observable to the human eye? Yeah.
Do you have any idea what was in their mind when they used the word electricity?
No, not at all. By no, I mean I'm not a psychic. I'm just doing, again, I'm trying to base myself on the words I have in front of me.
But they had to have some concept of electricity in order to say that it's prohibited or it's allowed to be used or not. Use more of it or less. They had to have some idea what...
So in terms of that, yes, and some of them were wrong. Like, there was one opinion that said that electricity was itself fire that was being transmitted through the currents. Now, you can understand why they get that. Well, hey, this is getting hot. It must be fire. Right? Not true. Or at least, you know...
But that totally guides the way they interpret these other prophecies that is electricity.
Possibly. But again, in this case, Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't seem comfortable defining it. Meaning, when he's saying here, it's possible that even without, you know, lighting it, you know, it's worthwhile looking into a greater detail. He doesn't know what biblical prohibition it is, generating more electricity. He just assumes that there's a problem with it. All right? So it doesn't seem to matter. It seems more of, we'll come up with a prohibition first and fit it in later. But the assumption isn't, well, this takes more effort and then we'll reach a conclusion. Right? He says, first, don't use it because of two possible biblical prohibitions, right? Now, he's got two definite rabbinic prohibitions. So remember we said in terms of plugging it in, so to speak, with old laws? So the biblical ones really fit into, whatchamacallit, the main ones being the 39 Avot Malacha, in terms of do you violate strict biblical Shabbat? So those were the intents of things like Bona, like you're building stuff and all that sort of thing. Molid, a little bit different category, but certainly in terms of building and, you know, igniting fires, those are on that big 39 category, right? But there are a lot of rabbinic enactments that they legislated, you're not supposed to do certain things on Shabbat, again, regardless of the mechanism by which you do it. Shalavis, take number three, please. So this is definite rabbinic one.
Since during the week the practice is to attach the electric microphone only when someone needs to speak and not before then. Therefore, even if there was no prohibition from the speaking, there is a rabbinic prohibition because the sages forbade putting grains in a water mill before Shabbos so that they will be ground on Shabbos. And therefore, since during the week one sets up the microphone only when one needs to speak, it is forbidden to set it up before Shabbos, for use on Shabbos, since it is possible to say that the electricity was set up the day before the drasha and the prayer. And it is, for this reason, it is forbidden to set up before Shabbos an electric radio or television to use on Shabbos itself.
Yeah. So here's his argument, okay? And in, like, summarizing, there are certain things you're not allowed to do on Shabbat. Or in this case, putting grains in a water mill before Shabbat, such that they're ground on Shabbat. Why? People are going to hear it being crunched, and they're going to think, hey, the guy's doing, he's being mehalal Shabbat. He's violating Shabbat, even though set it up beforehand. He says, because of that logic, we'll apply that. It's not quite Mari Ta'ayin, if anyone wants to make that distinction. At least not as I don't believe Mari Ta'ayin is used there. If anyone's interested, there's a whole separate class on that. You might say it's something similar, but here, you don't want to set it up before Shabbat, because if you do set it up before Shabbat, people are going to think that you actually set it up on Shabbat. Same thing, I know we spoke last week about timers. If you set your clock radio or your TV on a timer so that it's going to go off, people want to say, oh, the guy turned on his TV and turned on his clock on Shabbat. Thoughts about this argument?
I thought you're not supposed to think badly or poorly about your neighbor.
Well, it's not that. You might remember from this week in Daf Yomi, even though you're supposed to give people the benefit of the doubt, there are other areas where we take special precautions not to give people a reason to doubt us. So you're right, but it does go both ways. Yeah.
But how are any of these things different from turning on the light before Shabbos, let alone turning on these lights, or turning on a lamp, or even turning on a crock pot?
Yep, also true. In terms of turning it on before Shabbat, letting it go. So his argument seems to be, though, let's say you have a light, okay? Normally you only turn on lights Well, I shouldn't say that. People leave their lights on all the time, right? I know this because I used to do it. My mom used to yell at me, turn off the lights, right? Try to get a lot better with this. It's not uncommon for people to turn on lights and leave them. What Rav Moshe's arguing is, when people set up a microphone, no one sets up a live mic and lets it go all day. People expect it to be off, and there are enough politicians and recently a UN translator who ran into an issue with a hot mic, you may recall, because people think that it's off when you're not actually doing it, and people wound up caught saying what they really think. Mm-hmm. So the argument is, since the normal use for these things is for a short period of time, if you come set it up before, and people just assume that you must have done it on Shabbat, because no one in their right mind leaves a hot mic on all Shabbos long. Mm-hmm. Right? That is the distinction that he's making here. Now, let's say you're talking. Now, an interesting question would be, could you distinguish between people and what they do? Let's say you have, a house where they leave the radio on all the time. Let's say there's a place where they leave the TV on all the time. Guy's a news junkie, set to like CNN or Fox News, depending on your affiliation, right? Would that matter? It's like, well, yeah, he just has the TV on all the time. Right, as opposed to, oh, he must have turned it on for this specific thing. Granted, I think Rav Moshe wrote this in 1969, right? So people probably weren't as, like, plugged in as, you know, we are today.
In regarding the radio and the television to turn it on before Shabbos.
Yep.
Okay, and leave it on. If you're in the privacy of your own apartment, mm-hmm. and you do that, if you're turning it on before Shabbos, you're not breaking anything, nobody's gonna be thinking, they broke Shabbos because you're in your own private home.
You're hitting on a wonderful point here in terms of what are the specific things that Rav Moshe is mentioning, and I think these can reveal something about what Rav Moshe's intent is. Again, this is a bit of conjecture, but I think I can defend this. What he mentioned specifically here about using a microphone on Shabbat, he mentions Ayom Kodem Hadrasha V'Kodem HaTfilah. He's not talking about microphones in general, specifically about a sermon and prayer. You're talking about synagogue service with those two. Were these mostly used?
Conservative
and Reform. Who are the ones most likely to watch TV or listen to the radio on Shabbat? And I don't want to say conservative or reform, but those who might not be as observant. You could be technically correct on that. In privacy of your own home, who would know? But who are the people he's really speaking to? The ones who might be, let's say, I really don't know a good way of putting it. I don't want to say less observant. You're missing the point here. It's not just a matter of having guests over, but for the family that might be completely secluded, but might be on the borderline of observance,
yeah.
Right? They're not going to like play like, oh, TV's okay in this case, but it's not okay in that case. Say, I can watch TV on Shabbat, or I can't watch TV on Shabbat. And in terms of what does it mean to keep Shabbat, whether or not I can say it's a specific, hammer home an exact thing, although there may be other issues depending on what you watch on television. But today, people might resort to saying something like it's not Shabbos stick, which...
I've heard that.
Right. Which is not... I mean, there's a whole separate category which eventually we'll get to in the Sunday class about how does that all work. But that's going to be really unsatisfactory for people. That's saying, you can't watch TV on Shabbat just because. He's mentioning specific examples that were most relevant to the people in his day, be it to the other denomination synagogues or to the less observant Jews or the ones who might be on the margins, right? Technically, you could be right. If it was a case of straight up marit ayin, which I don't believe Rav Moshe actually uses those words, then it would be a matter of rabbinic decree that we did this again in the marit ayin class, any decree that was made because of marit ayin is also forbidden b'chadrei chadarim, in your innermost room. Why? Because in Jewish law, once sages pass a decree, a takana gzerah, the reason is no longer relevant. That is the law of what you must or cannot do, regardless if the situations change. We spent a lot of time in that in the halachic process class. Right? Otherwise, you can say, well, the reason no longer applies anymore. I will confess, I honestly don't follow this particular halacha. For many years, I woke up to a clock radio. Still do, in fact. Set to 880 WCBS AM. Anyone? At news, whatever. Right? It goes off at a set time. And then it turns... It's weird. We say it goes off when it goes on, too. Anyway, when the alarm... You know what I mean. Radio goes on at a certain set time, and it goes off like an hour later. Technically speaking, seems to be a problem with Rav Moshe, unless, you know, we say that, well, our technology and our usage has changed, that it's no longer a problem. I don't know if they... Did they have clock radios in the same way in 1969, George?
I don't recall.
I wasn't born for a while afterwards. I'm sorry for picking on. If anyone here remembers 1969, I'm sure it was a busy time for a lot of people here, depending on what y'all were on. But that was a drugs and Jewish law is a separate class.
Is it also possible that these statements are really politically motivated? You said about the conservative reform, but was there sort of not a dialogue, but a tension between the two, where Orthodox were afraid people were going to be joining? Conserve or accepting their decisions, and here he wants to cut them off from doing that or moving.
So the short answer is yes, and for the longer answer, see the like last bunch of lectures that I did in the Politics of Exclusion series, specifically on conservative Judaism. George, take the next one. This is reason number two, definite why you violate rabbinic law. Number, I have it marked as paragraph four. On page two.
There is another prohibition of a musical instrument that is forbidden unless one comes to fix it. For even a microphone, most people can fix it if it gets messed up while one is talking, and this happens many times. And this prohibition is also clear, rabbinic prohibition, and it does not help what was argued that
we do not know
how to fix the microphone, since once something is forbidden, by the sages, it is forbidden in all cases, even if someone creates a situation where it will not be fixed.
Now, this is wonderful here. Right? His main argument is, you may come to fix a microphone. Now, one dispensation that he is referring to is that by the Ba'alei Tosafot. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Okay. Little history here, and this has got me into a lot of trouble. But yeah. Very good. I wish I had chocolates I can throw on you for a little more things. Very good. Gemara in Beitza Lamed Amud Aleph, 30a, discusses it is forbidden by Jewish law to dance and clap on Shabbat and Yom Tov. The Ba'alei Tosafot there, and we did this in the Tosafot Shiur, say that by us it's permitted because we no longer know how to make musical, how to fix musical instrument. Right, let me rephrase that a bit. It's a Mishnah that appears in Lamed Vav Amud Aleph that says you're not allowed to dance and clap. And the Gemara says, because Shemi Yitakein Kli Shir, you may come to fix a musical instrument. There, the Tosafists say, since we now no longer know how to fix musical instruments, reason doesn't apply anymore, so it's all good. Rav Moshe Feinstein says what was forbidden rabbinically is even Etzesh Lo Yitakenu, even if you can somehow construct a microphone that cannot be fixed, or adjusted in any way. Here would be an example. Let's say you have a microphone that's embedded into the lectern, right? One way of doing it is, like most microphones, people know of these arm ones, right? We've got like a mic stand over there. So those, you know, you tweak, you adjust them. Let's say you've got one built into the stender. Can't really do anything with it. According to Rav Moshe, it still doesn't work anymore. Why? Because Rabbi still said that it was forbidden. Now, would Rav Moshe Feinstein argue that by that logic, should dancing and clapping also be forbidden all year round? I honestly never looked that up in him, but the same logic would apply. If you're going to reject this, if you're going to say Shemi Yitakein Kli Shir, the fact that you might come to fix the instrument is a problem here, even if the reason no longer applies. Well, I could agree with that, assuming he actually applies that idea consistently. But once you're going to say, well, you know, if you're going to be permissive about it, or rely on those who are permissive, to have hakafot or to hakafot and simchat Torah to clap, and to say, well, here it doesn't work either, there's a bit of an inconsistency there. All right? But at any rate, his argument is Reason number two why it's definitely rabbinically prohibited to use a microphone on Shabbat is you may come to fix it. And even if you set it up that you cannot possibly fix it, it's still a problem. Here's another quasi-political, and before we get to the questions, another reason why I say that this is more of a political response. Risa, take the last paragraph, please.
And therefore, it is clear that it is prohibited to use a microphone on Shabbat and Yom Tov. And there is no basis to be lenient, even in a great need. And therefore, it is forbidden to accept the position which requires one to use a microphone on Shabbat and Yom Tov.
Now, that last line, I think, is quite revealing. What he says is, barur, it is clear that a microphone is prohibited. When you actually like take apart the halachic reasoning, not so sure how clear it is. But that last line, I think, is incredibly telling. When he says, therefore, do not take a position that has, meaning a job, that requires you to use a microphone on Shabbat, what jobs do you think he's talking about?
But in 1969, it wasn't only the Reform and Conservative, there were still a lot of Orthodox synagogues.
There certainly were. We did a response also in the Politics of Exclusion class where Rav Moshe said it's better to go to an Orthodox-affiliated shul even if it has a microphone and doesn't have a kosher mechitz and then go to a conservative one. But that still, what are the places that he's talking about taking a position that requires you to use a microphone? It's about being a rabbi, most likely. I mean, I don't know how many from newscasters were there that would have to speak into a microphone. Who are the ones that really had this question? These are rabbis.
And actually, there is a shul in Queens in Forest Hills that is still, I think still thinks of itself as Orthodox, where you do have a microphone, but it's built in microphone.
Well, now you have passive field, and they're rabbis. They give heters to passive.
You've got a Tzomet, concoction there. Not going to get into Tzomet stuff. It's a little bit beyond me because it'll have to go through all the circuitry. At any rate.
In the earlier paragraph, he's saying that that most people can fix a microphone at that time.
It just means adjusting.
Adjusting. Meaning people, how many times have you, it's always too high, too low. Whether or not high or low counts as fixing it, as adjusting, I'm saying those are things that you do. Okay. Normally people don't pop one open, but you'll fix this.
I was thinking too literally.
That was fine.
People do that with instruments too. I mean, Tosafot did that with instruments. They thought literally meant fixing, but when you tune an instrument,
exactly. Yeah. But most people can tune it. No, that I would say is fixing an instrument. Certain instruments are very easy, like guitar. Assuming you can know how to change the tune of a guitar, you might not be on key or proper pitch or whatever. It's much harder to tune a piano. Anyone know that old joke? You can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish. No. Not only was that not my joke, a really deep cut. Anyone know which rock band actually used that as the name of one of their albums? No. A major gold star for anyone who gets this. REO Speedwagon. You're all better off not knowing that. But your random trivia for today. All right. So this is Rav Moshe explaining why microphones are bad, doing so emphatically, and those are some of my reasons why it might be more political. Now we get to hearing aids. Functionally, you would think that hearing aids were kind of the same way.
You might want to explain why there's it's going to show up.
Oh, really? Well, I've said it before. There's a performance of Chekhov upstairs. If anyone's hearing residual opera voice here that's coming through and whatnot, getting picked up by your own
little... It's kind of ironic that it comes up right as about to talk about hearing aids.
I think this is their last week here. And they sold out everything. Wonderful people, though. So if you've missed it, sorry, I think you've missed it, though.
It was good.
You liked it?
No, I didn't go.
Oh. I'm sorry for the digression. I'll tell you this. I'm sorry for the digression here. It was a little strange because a lot of stuff went off, and I couldn't tell what was part of the play and what wasn't. So, for example, one of the used a wooden chair as a prop, and guy banged it on the floor, and the chair fell apart. One of the characters broke character and started cracking up. And he continued laughing. And then I spoke to one of the people. I was like, oh, that continuation part was actually part of his character, and he was supposed to do that in the scene. Whereas I just saw it as a guy being completely unprofessional and, like, couldn't bring it back together. And a whole lot of other weird stuff. Guy, like, fell off one of our benches, came really close to being his head on a piano, which I couldn't tell based on the chair falling apart if that was intentional or not. So it was a really weird experience. Also, you know, Chekhov's Uncle Vanya isn't the most uplifting type of things. If anyone, Chekhov's quite depressing. So it's kind of weird to, like, get what's supposed to be, you know, real comic relief versus the, like, ironic Russian comic relief stuff. It's almost like the Jewish humor, where it's so pathetic it must be funny. Yeah. I will tell you this, that a lot of people did like it, and a lot of people did laugh. I don't know how many were native Russian speakers or whatnot, but I will say that...
It's in Russia?
No, but when Russian speakers went to it who have part of that culture, they're going to find things funny that I don't.
Oh.
But then again, with my sense of humor, I'm really not the one to judge. Sam, start us off with Igret Moshe. This is 485.
Regarding hearing aid for the deaf, if there is a prohibition, as we have discussed, regarding a microphone, in practice we are lenient here regarding a hearing aid, even though we forbade the use of a microphone for four reasons. Two for a suspected biblical prohibition, though the specifics were not clear, and two which were clear rabbinic prohibitions for reasons which I will explain.
Yeah. And, you know, we went through all of that. Okay.
The reason why a microphone was prohibited was because during the week, microphones are only set up at the time when someone is going to speak and not earlier. This is a prohibition only for when it is used to amplify one's voice to the masses. And just like one is prohibited from putting grains in a water mill, lest someone say it was placed there on Shabbat, this is a similar instance only regarding a microphone, which is used in public but not for a hearing aid, which is not heard by anyone else at all.
Now this goes to Shalamis's point, right? The reason he made the analogy, okay, between the mill that other people can hear, and that's a problem, like a microphone, because people can hear the microphone doing stuff, right? So that's why those two are parallel. But the hearing aid, who hears the hearing aid? Only one person. So here he seems to make a distinction between that which is public is going to be prohibited for that reason, that which is private should be permitted for that reason. Oh, but what does that mean for the television and radio? Don't know what to tell you. All right? But he's aware of this.
But other people can see that it's being used. Ah. Infer that it's being used.
You only see that it's in the ear. We'll actually get there in a bit. You only see that it's in the ear. How do you know that they're actually using it?
It's true. Why would they have it in their ear and be responding to
this? So at the risk of really shocking you, there are some people who have hearing aids who are incredibly stubborn and don't like using them.
But why do they...
Very good, George! I actually had a friend who, an audiologist, used to sell hearing aids, and he had, like, a whole bunch of crazy stories, including one really bad one with insurance, where someone's claim was denied because they didn't put down whether or not it was for the left or the right ear. And he said, well, if I would have put down right ear, would you have approved the claim? Yeah. If I would have put down left ear, would you have approved the claim? It's like, yeah. It's like, oh, so you just don't want to pay the claim, because it clearly doesn't matter. And that's an... Yeah.
What about a radio with... earphone?
Ooh, Walkman.
Yeah, I don't think in 1969.
Interesting point. I don't know if... Well, they did have headphones, but even those headphones... That's a good point. Mark, did you have something?
No.
Okay. So, that's argument one. Let's continue. And the reason that since anyone can fix the instrument, this under the prohibition of a musical instrument... We find this too is inapplicable regarding hearing aids, because hearing aids are only for the deaf. One may consider hearing aids to be so rare that there would not have been an enactment. Now let me explain this for a second here. Chazal, when they came to decrees, right, exempted certain things or intentionally did not make decrees for things that were so uncommon. Example, normally... You are not allowed to be secluded with some of the opposite gender. We call that yichud. A man is not allowed to be secluded with a woman who isn't his wife. But what about a man and his daughter, right? Since, though, there were instances of incest were so rare, the sages did not set up a rule saying a man is not allowed to be in a room alone with his daughter. Okay? Good parallel there. So he says here that they are so rare that there would not have been an enactment in terms of might coming to fix it. It wouldn't have happened. Furthermore, there is a great need for those who need hearing aids, for without them there's a possibility of saving a life. What he calls a chashash pikuach nefesh. If someone wants to go outside and would not be able to hear passing cars, there is the possibility to argue that there was no enactment for this case. So his argument here is, well, twofold again. One is that it was rare, and two, because this is used for a specific purpose, Chazal would not have made a decree because people need it in order to cross the street. And so, that one does not come to suspect that one may fix the instrument, one must examine when it was appropriate to make the enactment, and if this item was included in that original enactment. But since hearing aids would not have been included, we do not have the same halachic worry that one may forget and come to fix the hearing aid. And we find from these clear prohibitions that we have by microphones, we do not have by hearing aids. Rav Moshe Feinstein here is engaging in what I could only call speculation. It's not that hearing aids are different, but rather he's trying to intuit what did Chazal really mean when they made this decree, and to say, well, it would have applied to microphones, but it wouldn't have applied to hearing aids for such and such a reason. To say, even if there was a decree against fixing a musical instrument, no, that clearly they wouldn't have done that in this case. Evidence for it? Not so much. Yeah.
It just seems that here's an attempt that he's trying to be lenient.
Yep.
Where before he had a political reason for being very stringent.
Yep.
And so this is, he's reasoning his way out of that box.
You could say the reasoning was out of the box for both of them. Meaning we spent enough time, you know, the first half of this class going through the first one, how even internally might be logically off. Here, he's not just trying to say why hearing aids are okay. He's trying to have it both ways. He's trying to say, why is this okay for hearing aids and also bad for microphones? Right? And he's trying to come up with a difference. So,
in one case, he's trying to cut off the left...
Well, that was conjecture. In fairness, he did not mention that explicitly.
No, hold it.
It's important to realize. That was my conjecture. I think it's defensible, but he did not say that explicitly. We may be able to intuit, well, it makes sense why he would want to forbid one and why he would want to permit the other, okay. Which is a very different statement. All right? Take the next paragraph for us, please.
In his last position, when he's talking about not using a microphone, he says... there's no basis to be lenient, even in a great need. So,
yep.
Would he be arguing then that if you can't reach someone by voice who's going to walk into the street unbeknownst to them, you can't use a microphone?
That is a spectacular question, isn't it? Meaning, what's the real thing about great need here? If it's a matter of great need, what constitutes great need? So, usually when you talk about pikuach nefesh, saving a life, there's no greater need than that. If there was even a full-fledged biblical prohibition, you're allowed to violate that to save a life on Shabbat. All right? Yeah.
Would a deaf person be permitted to have an aliyah since he can't hear the reading of the Torah?
Way off topic there. Okay, next one. And the concerns.
And the concerns that the voice being heard from the hearing aid are not man-made, but rather recorded. Even if one says... that this occurs by a hearing aid. Since this prohibition is not clear, it is not in our hands to prohibit it for a sick person or for great need if the prohibition is uncertain.
It is phenomenal. So what he was so emphatic on by microphone about it being, you know, clearly this is prohibited. I've got two possible biblical. It's like, well, for just a biblical, a maybe biblical, we're not going to forbid it for someone who needs. Okay?
Yeah, they might need the microphone.
Look, you want to talk about, is it pikuach nefesh? The answer is not necessarily. I mean, there are lots of other ways for people to get to shul that don't require use of a hearing aid. You go with someone else. Maybe don't cross the street. Maybe don't leave your house and have a minion come to you, right? If it was really that prohibited, Right? Pikuach nefesh is usually reserved for things where you've got an imminent threat of danger, and you need to do this in order to live, or you know, something along those lines. There are lots of ways of getting around this that you don't have, you know, we don't employ a whole bunch of, you know, heterim for stuff like this.
And of course, if it was pure pikuach nefesh, this would be a one-sentence decision. It would be pikuach nefesh's end of discussion. Mm. What he's really saying is there's a need that doesn't rise to the level of pikuach nefesh.
Well, he says chashash pikuach nefesh. He calls it chashash pikuach nefesh. Might be. All right, so continue. And specifically?
And specifically, it seems that with this device, it is not a new voice being created, because the voice is not being amplified over one, what someone is able to hear. And what the deaf person can hear is only through directing the sound to the ear directly without any interruption of that increasing the power would increase the ability to hear. And even the experts, we do not know for certain, and we find another reason to be in doubt.
His argument is, to my understanding, technically flawed.
Wrong, yeah.
Yeah, right? It's the way that I understand it is, the way he, Rav Moshe Feinstein, understands hearing aids in 1969, I don't think he was correct about this then, even though there have been advances made, is hearing aids don't actually make a new sound. All they do is direct sound right into the ear. So think of it as a magnifying glass for sound. Right? Now, to my knowledge, that's not how these things work. Anyone here who was around in 1969 knew what a hearing aid was. Were they battery-powered?
Yeah.
Okay, how did they work? They... Am I correct in saying that had that whole diaphragm thing in turn? Okay, then.
I mean, the only difference is now that they're solid state instead of whatever they eat, transistors. Now, large-scale integration, they're very tiny.
All right, take the next paragraph.
Where are we?
And the second concern.
And the second concern, that more sound increase the use of electricity also increases, is also not a clear prohibition, nor is it a clear doubt. Therefore, there is no suspicion here to forbid it for a sick person who has a great need.
All right. Another case where he says, well, for great need, that whole chashash to oraita may be biblical. Yeah. Nah, we'll just ignore it. Take the next one. Here's where it gets super fun.
And regarding... Oh. Yeah.
No, continue. That was a short paragraph.
And regarding this specific instance, the deaf person who places the hearing aid in his ear does not do any action. It is only directed on those who speak.
All right, speak. And I put that in italics here because I put it in. When you mentioned about passivity, well, this seems to be passive. I can put it in. I'm not doing anything wrong, right? It only works on other people. When I speak into a microphone, I'm the active one doing this. All right, continue.
And the speakers do not speak in particular to the deaf, but rather in general, and they do not intend any prohibition to occur.
All right, so stop there for a second. And the speaker, when I speak to someone, people pick up my sounds when I speak. Well, let me, if I talk, a lot of people hear me, not everyone listens, right? But I'm not, this seems to be the only problem if I'm speaking specifically to a deaf person in order so that he should hear. But if the deaf person happens to pick up my ambient noise, well then, I haven't really intended that. And it gets even better. Hold on. Gets even better.
And there is no psikleshe even...
Since,
even with a hearing aid, the deaf person might still not be able to hear.
Now, anyone... Again, this is like chocolate gold star-worthy thing here. Anyone know why I put that line in underlines? We remember this past Sunday, we spoke about a psikresha being prohibited, which is... You remember? Psikresha meant cutting off the head of a chicken.
So that the kid could play.
Right. Now, do you remember the halakhic implications? Sorry if you're picking on you, but I remember that you were there on Sunday.
Yeah, you might use it as a barola.
Yeah, missing the point here. As a halakha concept for Shabbos.
Because this chicken's going to die. Did you get that thing about the chicken that didn't die?
We're not talking about the chicken. It's when you know, when an action that you do inevitably results in Chilul Shabbat, it is prohibited. Whereas when the action, if what you do it is not inevitable, meaning maybe you do, maybe you don't, and you just don't care about it, then it's okay. But if you know with certainty it's going to violate Shabbat, you're not allowed to. We get that from Psik Resha, cutting off the head of a chicken. Regardless of what your intent is, cutting off the head of a chicken is going to kill a chicken. Right? So his argument here is that that doesn't even count Because the hearing aid doesn't always work. Anyone can get the $100,000 question on this one.
Is there a switch that you turn it on?
Yeah. Bad question. No. Not new.
The microphone doesn't always work, too.
And?
And that's a reason for prohibiting it.
Boom! There you go. One of the reasons... I will explain. I'm sorry. I get excited over this.
No, but I understand.
One of the reasons why Rav Moshe Feinstein said a microphone was absolutely definitively prohibited rabbinically is because you might come to fix it. But one of the reasons why a hearing aid is permissible is because it doesn't always work.
Wow.
Anyone else see that as weird?
Yeah. It doesn't make sense because you wouldn't be using a hearing aid if it didn't work.
That's also not true. As my friend who worked selling hearing aids, that's not a factually true statement. People are stubborn. Do not underestimate the stubbornness of people, especially people who need hearing aids. Just trust me. Trust me, that's a reality, but that's also not the logical problem in Rav Moshe. The logical problem in Rav Moshe is the very reason why he said microphones are forbidden is the very reason why he says hearing aids are okay. Or even flip it the other way. If it's really a chashash pikuach nefesh, if you know having a hearing aid is so important, who do you think's going to adjust it? Where do you think there's a greater chance of adjusting? A microphone or a hearing aid that, maybe it'll save your life, maybe not.
A hearing aid, because you...
Yeah, it was a rhetorical question. Right? Okay. Sorry. Carry on. Take the last thing.
I was just going to say, in Rob Moshe's defense, I think maybe he wasn't saying that the deaf person would try to fix it, just maybe the hearing aid isn't strong enough.
Regardless, right? If one of the reasons why it's not a psik resha is because it won't always work, then that's a problem. Because certainly the speaker might not fix it, but the guy who's wearing the hearing aid most probably will.
That might try to fix it, yes.
Maybe he is also banking on the stubbornness of people with hearing aids.
Yeah.
And that he's possibly like, nah, they'll just leave it alone. They'll think everything is fine. Right? But according to this, wouldn't be allowed to adjust it. Continue. And for those.
Only for those who speak to the deaf person specifically. Then there is the case of a psik resha, or minimally intentional act. Therefore, one should not speak solely to a deaf person and restrict the use of the hearing aid to most things which he must hear in the street or in shul. And on those things which are asked, one should only answer indirectly. And if this is impossible, e.g. a six-year-old girl, where one must respond orally, there is no need to prohibit the use of the hearing aid.
So he does even make that distinction of, well, one way to get around this is don't speak to a deaf person with a hearing aid directly. Rather, you speak generally, or you send, I don't know like how this works in terms of like a weird, you know, intermediate, like, you know, one should answer indirectly or like through some. I don't even know how this works in practice because, like.
If you don't know.
Exactly. Or if I tell you to speak to that person, then I'm making you do the biblical the rabbinic prohibition.
Yeah,
so I can't do that either.
And you're allowed to have that hearing aid, so you talk to him.
Anyway.
But
If you're confused, you're not the only one.
Well, in the definitive rabbinic prohibition, he's saying you can't use a microphone because there's a chance, a possibility that somebody could fix it.
Yep.
But we're not talking here about a chance that you might, that somebody else could fix it or that you might be speaking to them directly. We're ignoring the possibility.
Yes, absolutely. The whole point of doing this and like going through these two classes is that in terms of halachic reasoning, both are weak. Weak on the merits if we take them independently. When you take them collectively, from a pure halachic standpoint, it's beyond the level of absurd. These two, in my opinion, only make sense if you're talking about someone who's arguing from a not purely halachic legalistic consistency perspective, but someone who's trying to set up a halachic policy for the needs of his constituents. Intuitively, we understand why someone would want to permit hearing aids. Right, but you can also see why someone in Rav Moshe's position, especially in 1969, would have wanted to have forbidden microphones and also, you know, televisions and radios. Right, which is why. And remember when I introduced it as, you know, I think these are political. This is the reason why, Because if you hold Rav Moshe Feinstein to a consistent, coherent halachic standard, these two fail miserably, independently, and on their own. Too many questions to be asked, right? That just, they just fall apart, right? But on the flip side, Rav Moshe was not in a position where he could just duck questions, and people took what he said very seriously. Had he ruled differently, you can imagine where the Jewish world would be. Like, if Rav Moshe said you can't use hearing aids on Shabbat, what would have happened? Or if Rav Moshe said you're allowed to use microphones on Shabbat, what would have happened? Right? It's not a fun position to be in, and it's the reason why, you know, people read through, when people read through these responsa, I don't think it's being dismissive to say that they're responding to their needs, and in some ways you actually can appreciate the challenges that they faced. And that way, to me at least, I know not everyone agrees with this, I appreciate Rav Moshe Feinstein a lot more than that, than if I look at it from pure halacha. Because if I look at this from pure halacha, I don't take him seriously at all. I look at him as someone to whom a huge segment of the Jewish population turned to, right? Then it's a very different thing. Now, what does this mean for our discussion on electricity as a whole? There are political issues involved. And that, to my mind, I don't think you can ignore that they have crept in every now and again. At the end of the day, is it, you know, consistent in this regard? Probably not. Is one thing mutar, one thing asur? Well, probably, but I can also understand why no one would want to get up and say so, because of ramifications of what's going to happen. You can call this a slippery slope, or itself a psik resha of Shabbat, so to speak, where if by saying, well, if such and such a thing is okay, what is going to happen? And the truth is, it also depends who says it. Meaning, I get up and I say something stupid, very few people care. Or if Moshe Feinstein gets up and says anything, a lot of people care. Right? And I've said stuff that other people have said years later. No one listens to me, they listen to the other guy. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, just how things work. Not, doesn't mean that I was more correct or more incorrect. There's a social, political role that's going on here. Yeah. Probably, I honestly am not as up on Rav Soloveitchik's writing, particularly the halachic writings. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a lot more halachically and certainly coherent halacha. Rav Moshe Feinstein is a lot easier to understand. His Hebrew even being what it is and how often he quotes English in his Hebrew. To my mind, it's just a lot clearer than Rav Soloveitchik. If anyone's interested, there's a Rabbi Herschel Schachter at Yeshiva University has, I think they're up to two or three volumes, definitely two, maybe even three volumes of excerpts of stuff that he has from Rav Soloveitchik. But let's not forget, people still fight over Rav Soloveitchik's legacy. And since not as much was committed, at least with, not as much was committed to Rav Soloveitchik in terms of the halacha stuff, so you're dealing with reports, this is at least what Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote himself. People still argue on what he really meant, but at least I've got his own words to work with. So that's why I sooner do that. Yeah.
So why couldn't he have said, this is a close, he could have, if he'd been perhaps a little more locked in, so this is a, these are both close calls, but with the hearing aid, there's more of a pressing need. So I think, you know, we should probably err on the side of leniency here. With the microphones, there's really not a good reason for it. And on balance, I wouldn't do it, but he could have perhaps been less emphatic.
Politically, that would have been a concession. You can see that today in politics, where people need to take extreme positions to distinguish themselves from others. And unless you take such a strong position and you equivocate, the other side says, oh, you see, so-and-so really agrees with us. It would have been, the more emphatic that he was, the more his followers will be, oh, Moshe said it can't possibly be done. More people, based on just what I've seen today, granted, again, I was not alive in 1969. The way that I see more people deal with halacha is they only work on the conclusion. They don't care about the logic. They don't, and that's all that they're going to take away. So if all they take away is Rav Moshe said it's super bad to use a microphone on Shabbat, no one's going to know why. No one's going to care why. But if he says Rav Moshe Feinstein said it could go either way, how does that get transmitted to everyone else? So could he have? And we discussed a bit about that with Mechitza. Rav Soloveitchik came up with a brand new biblical prohibition for it. But had he equivocated even slightly, it would have been a major concession to the conservatives, which at the time I don't think he would have been willing to handle. That's one of the issues you have with political types of decisions. You sacrifice a bit of nuance because you just have to, because your constituents, your constituents don't care about nuance. Like, if I'm speaking to just the people in this room, People are thoughtful. You can appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I don't have 100,000 people hanging on my every word. Uh-huh. If I did, mm-hmm. I'd have to speak very differently. Mm-hmm. So one of the perks about, you know, not having throngs of followers, right? So important to keep that in mind. All right. And we will not have our Wednesday class next week, so we will pick it up in two. Have a wonderful week. And again, you're free to come to the Sunday class that we're doing, Rambam and Hilchot Shabbat. You are.